Hi, I'm Kelly.
And I'm Sophie.
We're two broads talking politics.
We're working moms in the Midwest.
Who love politics.
We're progressive activists.
Worried about the future of our country for our kids.
On Two Broads Talking Politics, we talk to activists and authors and veterans and students and reporters and nonprofit directors and candidates. Lots of candidates.
On Wednesdays, we do deep dives into issues like the opioid crisis or gun violence or reproductive justice or religion or the politics of a particular state. And on Fridays, I profile an individual or three.
So if you like talking politics or just want to be hopeful about the country again, check out Two Broads Talking Politics.
We're at twobroadstalkingpolitics.com, or you can subscribe anywhere podcasts are found.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
And I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm talking to you about two ladies.
Me too!
Oh my God.
It's story time.
Story time at The Bitchery of History. Today, I'm talking to you about Marguerite de Brézouges. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Go for it.
As well as Europa.
Ooh, I am going to be talking about Tanake and one of my personal favorites, Atalanta.
Oh my word. It is a legendary mythological episode today.
It's going to be legend.
Dairy.
Perfect.
Great. Okay.
Okay.
You go first.
Get ready.
Okay.
This story is crazy town. Okay, so Tanake is a figure in South African folklore. She was the eldest daughter of a great Basotho chief who died. So she was left to raise her two younger brothers, basically turning into single mom.
Okay.
So what I'm going to share is one version of the story. Mm-hmm. There's obviously like bunches and bunches of them, but this is kind of the most basic one with the facts that appear through most. And okay. Then at the end, I'll kind of say, here's one other alternate version, which
sure,
is kind of
sure.
fun.
Okay.
But basically, the two younger brothers were very, very lazy. They didn't want to do anything. So Tanake had to take them to warrior school, which was way up in the mountains, and prepare everything they needed for graduation. Their clothes, their shields, their weapons. But the brothers deemed these clothes not good enough.
Oh, she made them with her hands.
Yeah, and refused to leave their training hut. Since they were the sons of the chief, they wanted clothes that were better than anyone else, including shields made out of a nanaboleli skin. Let me say this again. Nanaboleli skin.
Okay.
Now, this is a water-dwelling dragon. Okay. Henceforth, will be called Dragon.
Okay. I was about to say, is that an animal?
A water-dwelling dragon. It's a creature that glows in the dark and arrives in a cloud of red smoke. It's a dragon.
Okay.
It's a dragon.
Yeah, a pretty cool-looking dragon.
Yeah, a water dragon.
Glows in the dark and a red smoke.
Yeah.
I appeared to puff of red smoke.
Please. The brothers were basically asking their sisters to go find one, defeat it, and then bring back the skin.
Excuse me. I'm going to sit in my hut and you go slay this dragon.
Yeah, right. So when Tanake protested, they told her, well, the chief would have done it for them. Like, these boys are such brats.
Oh, my God.
So she returned to the village and told the villagers that she had to go fight a dragon and was looking for volunteers to help her out. And they were just aghast at this request. And she reminded them that if the chief were still alive, this is exactly what he would do. And no one would question it. It was a tradition of the tribe, and young men graduating warrior school would receive these gifts made of animal skins defeated by their father. Since the boys had no father, the responsibility fell to Tanake. So she told the villagers, quote, if they lack anything, these sons of a chief, I will not be to blame for it. I will go and hunt these dragons. End quote.
I am obsessed. I'm in love.
It's the best. So now here's the thing. The villagers eventually are like, okay, all right, girl, we'll help you out. The problem is, no one knew where to find a dragon.
It glows in the dark and then appears in a puff of red smoke.
No. Here's the thing. So Tanake basically goes to a river, throws in some meat, and starts singing a song that's intended to taunt someone's opponent, which is not what I would do for a dragon. Like, never tickle a sleeping dragon,
she
okay?
Got no fear.
This
no
is
fear.
She's so throws some meat in the water and then is basically like, come and get me.
Come and get me.
Now, a dragon was not there, but a frog did come out of the stream and told her and the villagers that they just had to keep going until, quote, they could dip water with the husk of the poison plant, and there you must cross. Now, don't worry, because no one else was sure what this meant either. They were just as confused as us.
So real clear, Mr. Frog.
Yeah, thank you so much. They continued down the stream, tossing in meat and singing the taunting song, but the only thing that kept coming up were talking frogs telling them to keep going. So they eventually get to a larger part of the stream,
The same talking frog or just different talking
frogs? Talking frogs.
That's
plural.
Amazing. Okay.
So more talking frogs. So they eventually get to a large part of the stream, and no matter how much meat they threw in, nothing happened. So they just decide, well, let's just throw a whole ox in. That will do the trick. So they throw in an ox, and the water starts bubbling, and they're all preparing for a fight. But instead of a dragon appearing from the water, it was an old woman, and she took them down underneath the water to a deserted village.
Oh, my word.
The old lady told them a story that the dragon had eaten everyone in her village except for her, because her skin was too tough
She's
from working
She's
hard
She's
her whole
dragon.
Life. No, you don't know. Just listen.
I don't know.
She was left alive, but she was the only one there taking care of them. And when she heard Tanaka's song, she decided she wanted to help her out. So she heard her and the villagers in a hole until the herd of dragons returned. Now, side note, apparently dragons travel in a herd.
Oh, they look for one and they got many.
So when they did finally return, they could smell the humans, but they couldn't find them. So eventually all the dragons just go to sleep. So that's when Tanaka struck and killed the largest one and took its body with her.
Oh my God. Good for her.
The old woman gave the group a pebble that could turn into a mountain so they could ward off future attacks from the dragon, because obviously you've killed one of their own. It's inevitable the dragons are going to come after you
They're
and attack
you
more. So the Basotho people thanked the old woman by giving her two oxen. Now, she was right. The surviving dragon attacked the group multiple times during their journey back to the village. But each time, Tanaka threw the pebble on the ground and it grew into a huge mountain that the dragon could not get around, which is a freaking ginormous mountain. So the dragon came one more time for revenge after the crew and Tanaka returned to the village. But Tanaka released the village dogs on them. And, you know, the dogs were so scary and the dragons weren't expecting them that they just left the people alone
Man's
for
best
good.
Friend.
Yeah. Dogs versus dragons. Who will win?
Dogs, duh.
Dogs, apparently, every time. Now, Tanaka had someone make her brother's shields, blankets, and hats, and some clothes and shoes out of the dragon skin and gave them to her back at warrior school. And they were so impressed that they finally left their hut to show off their clothes. And as a thank you to Tanaka, they gave her 100 cattle. Now, when the story is told, it ends with a phrase which means, "This is a true tale of the Basotho people," which I guess is happily ever after.
Okay.
Now, there's another version of the story that involves a prince. In this version, no one had even seen a dragon before. They'd only heard of it. But Tanaka's brothers were so spoiled that they demanded that she go get this dragon skin anyway. And she decides to find the dragon for her brothers as a point of pride and honor.
Uh-huh.
And in this version, none of the villagers would help because they didn't like how spoiled her brothers were acting. So they were like, you got to do it on your own. The story of her mission and her request for help spread all over Africa until it reached Prince Misalo, and when he heard of this brave girl who decided to go on a hunting expedition for the sake of the family honor, he felt a strange excitement at such a bold plan. He also felt ashamed that no man in the whole country could be found willing to go with her to the land of the dragons to kill one for her. Praise. Yeah. That is what you call an ally.
That's
Thank you. Like, seriously, no man is going to come try and hunt a dragon with
you.
Her.
None of
one.
You.
Literally in the whole continent of Africa. So he lived hidden away, kind of like Jasmine and Aladdin. And so he escaped from this palace to find Tanaka and help her. And so even though he wasn't allowed to go out, he was somehow still a famed fighter, like, you know.
Practicing behind the walls, sure.
I guess. So he fell in love with her at first sight, of course.
Duh.
And tells her that he will come with her. And she shrugs and is basically like, okay.
If you want.
Whatever. I'm killing a dragon. Like, you can come if you want to, but you don't have to.
You carry your own pack.
Yeah. All of the villagers gave her the oxen to throw in the river because they felt guilty about not going with her. Now, in this story, it's, of course, the prince who kills the dragon, throwing a spear into its hide. And the two get married once they return to the village, and she lives out the rest of her days as queen. So, not a terrible ending.
Sure, sure. I'll take the second story where he's an ally, but with the first story where she kills the dragon.
Right, exactly. I want a blending.
I like that one better.
It really reminds me of one of my favorite books of all time, The Paperbag Princess, which I should buy you a copy.
Yes, please.
I'm Jeanette and Kim and everyone. Jess what and is Sydney. It? It's, oh my God. Okay, so The Paperbag Princess, my grandmother bought it, I think, a copy like for herself at one point. It's an older kid's book. This story basically... Oh gosh, now we're gonna have five stories. Okay, so the story basically is that there's this prince and princess that are engaged to be married, and then a dragon comes to the village and breathes fire and burns down the whole village and carries off the prince to the cave. Oh. And the princess, all her clothes were burned and her whole castle was burned, so all she can find to wear is a paper bag. So she puts on a paper bag and is like, I gotta go rescue my prince. Shows up to the cave, outsmarts the dragon by being like, I hear you can fly around the world 100 times. I hear you can burn up 100 forests, and like wears him out till he falls asleep. And then rescues the prince and is basically like, hey, prince, I rescued you. And the prince goes, you look terrible. Your hair's a mess. You're wearing a paper bag. Like, come back when you look like a real princess.
Up.
To which the paper bag princess responds, you know, you look really nice and you smell great and you look like a real prince, but you are not a prince. You are a bum. And the last line is, and they didn't get married after all.
Oh my God.
All of the snaps. I'm like, this is, I buy that book for almost every one of my girlfriends on their birthdays.
That's amazing.
Like, I've given it.
That's like the perfect Galentine's Day gift.
It's so good. I've given it to Isabel. I don't think I've given a copy to Beverly, but I might have. I've given it to all the kids, all the girls I nanny for.
Good.
Immediately. So go to Barnes & Noble, pick up a copy for like $5.99.
I need to get that for my sister.
Oh, yes. Both of them. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's so, so good.
Oh, my word. All right. Are you ready?
I am so ready.
From Marguerite de Brézouche.
I am ready.
So not much is really known about her.
All right.
And if you look it up, Rejected Princesses has done a great job of, they did a story and then they went back and they did a bunch of corrections about it. And that's actually where we got a lot of the information,
because
information on her is sparse. But essentially, what is known is that she was born sometime in the early to mid 1400s. She's the princess of this royalist castle in France. And at the time, there were renegade nobles that were going from castle to castle and attacking the other royalist households.
What?
And during one of these main skirmishes, Marguerite and all of her ladies-in-waiting were captured by Louis de Chalon, the Prince of Orange. And her, along with her 11 women-in-waiting, were all raped at the hands of him and their men.
Blah.
Exactly. He also, in the process, kills her mother and father, along with, you know, a lot of other people in the castle as well.
Okay.
Now, after the assault, she and the other woman found refuge with the Baroness of Anjou, where they would receive weaponry and train on horseback and in the arts of war. So learning how to fight and use a sword and to go to battle. They joined these troops that were going to attack Louis de Chalon and all of his troops. And the way the story goes is that the two armies are facing each other, and out of nowhere, these 10 black knights appear.
What? Oh, I am so on board for this. I see where this is going. Okay.
They were dressed entirely in black armor. They wore black crepe veils over their helmets and carried a black banner depicting the bones of enemies strewn about and an orange pierced by a spear emblazoned with the words, Anzi tu seras, which means you will be so.
Holy buckets. I would poop my pants if I was in that army.
Literally.
That is like a cross between Ringwraiths and Dementors and pirates coming after you.
So the lead knight unmasks himself to reveal that it's Marguerite herself.
Yes. Blessings.
She says, I know the risks of war and I won't be denied my revenge.
Oh, yes.
So, of course, they let her join and the rest of them as well.
On board.
And
on
so,
board.
Along with Raoul de Goncourt, which is the forces that they joined, On May 29th, 1430, according to legend, and throughout June of that year, they fight several battles, and they prove that they can fight. They fight battles at the castles of Pusignan, Aziz, Saint-Romain, and Colombières. And the Battle of Antun, which was on June 11th, 1430, according to Mathieu Thomassin, who was one of Louis XI's counselors, this is the battle that they had waited for. Finally, they were confronting rapists.
Oh, man.
Now, the Black Knights tore across the battlefield, each one cornering their rapists and removing their masks to let the men know exactly who had come for them. Apparently, and according to the legend, each man froze upon realizing who had come for them, thinking that it was a ghost come from hell to enact their revenge.
Yeah, a hell you created, buddy.
Literally. But hell hath no fury.
Oh man.
So unfortunately, at this battle, Marguerite is actually severely wounded almost right near the beginning. Mm. And what makes that so unfortunate is that no help was going to come for her until the battle was over. So by the time the battle finished, she was gone, unfortunately. She was buried with full military honors. Her grave stood with the banner.
Yes, please.
Speared orange.
Yes, please.
And the rest of her ladies went and joined a convent. And they lived their life out there. Their revenge having been taken.
That's amazing.
And that is the legend of Marguerite de Bréjeux. Now, I should say there has been research done to say that it's possible she never existed.
Mm-hmm.
There's research that says it's possible she existed but died well before the events of these battles. It's possible that all of this is true.
Well, also possible that dragons don't live in the waters of Africa.
Exactly.
So, you know, you take what you can get.
Exactly.
Hey, friends. If you're enjoying this podcast, do a quick favor for me and look down at your phone or your computer, your iPad, tablet, whatever you're listening on, and leave us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the show, which helps us keep doing the show. Thanks.
If you have already left us a review and you're looking for more ways to get involved and help this podcast happen, you should go to your app store or your Android marketplace, whatever it's called, and download the Patreon app. On patreon.com/UrsulaMajor or through the Patreon app, you can search for Ursula Major, where we put bloopers and deleted scenes and extra bits and all that other fun stuff. And you get to make this happen every single day. Thanks.
Okay.
So,
Atalanta, you really don't remember her story?
I don't.
Okay. So when I had the flu when I was younger, I basically read Edith Hamilton's Mythology cover to cover in a week.
Uh-huh.
Because what else
because
is there to do?
Because it's one of the best books. Because
it's great. And also, I was on Tamiflu, so like I didn't feel sick, but no one in my family would come talk to me. I was like in quarantine alone for a week. It's such an Allison week. I'm trying to remember how old I was. Maybe like 14.
Uh-huh.
I read Edith Hamilton's Mythology, listened to classical music, and colored dresses for like a week. I drew dresses.
I'd love to see those drawings.
You know what? Dresses and houses are like all I can draw. So.
Okay. All right.
So it's fine. I'm sure there's a whole sketch pad of them. Yeah. Anyway, just very Alison Powell. Like, was I watching TV all day? Watching movies? No.
It sounds like a weekend when you're not sick. It sounds like something you do when you
weren't. Or it sounds like it was 1920 and I had TB. Like, it's both of them at once.
I'm recuperating from my long bed sickness.
Yeah. Ooh, anywho, reading through Edith Hamilton's Mythology, almost all the stories are about men, of course, and heroes. But then I came across this one short story about Atalanta. And ever since then, I was like, this girl is dope.
Yes.
Okay, so get ready.
Okay.
Okay.
Now it's Atalanta. There's
Atalanta.
An A in there.
There is an A. Mm-hmm. And I did double check the pronunciation. It's not Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
It's Atalanta.
Okay.
Atalanta. So, of course, the king wanted a son. Boo, boo. When Atalanta was born, he left her on a mountaintop to die. Boo, boo. Some stories say that a she-bear suckled and cared for Atalanta until hunters found and raised her, and she learned to fight and hunt as a bear would. But she was later reunited with her father. So who knows?
Like, what up, bro?
Right. So having grown up in the wilderness, Atalanta became a fierce hunter and was always happy. She took an oath of virginity to the goddess Artemis.
Okay.
Now, all right. There's a couple different sort of stories about her. I'm going to save my favorite. And I think the only one that's in mythology for last. Mm-hmm. The other ones that I found online, I'm just going to share briefly.
Okay.
One is Jason and the Argonauts.
Okay.
Apparently, in many versions of the quest for the Golden Fleece, for instance, that published by Robert Graves in 1944, uh-huh. Atalanta sailed with the Argonauts as the only woman among them.
Nuh-uh.
I never knew this. Yeah, I never knew this until a few days ago. I don't think it's in mythology. I don't know why it's mentioned. She's not in the movie.
Now tell me why she's not in
Here's what happened. So she jumped aboard the ship soon after the expedition set out. So she wasn't welcome, she came anyway.
Hey, guys.
Invoking the protection of Artemis, whose virgin priestess she was. So she's like, can't hurt me. I'm a virgin priestess of Artemis.
Took that vow.
So she was following Meleager, who had put away his young wife, a.k.a. I guess...
Put away?
Divorced? For Atalanta's sake. And Atalanta returned his love, but was prevented by an oracle from consummating their union because she was warned that losing her virginity would prove disastrous for her.
Sure.
So she was like, I love you, but the oracle says I cannot do it.
Close for business.
So bye-bye. In disappointment, Meleager joined the Argo because, like, I guess the only reason that you're good for me is if we can do it. So peace. But Atalanta would not let him out of her sight, so she jumps aboard the ship. She plays a major part in various adventures of Jason's crew. She suffered an injury in battle and was healed by Medea. Apollonius of Rhodes, on the other hand, claims that Jason would not allow a woman on the ship because she would cause strife among the otherwise all-male expedition.
Oh, the men won't be able to concentrate. They're gonna fight over her. You're a bunch of strapping men finding a mythical golden fleece.
Also, hold up real quick, bros. She literally was raised by a bear. So let's not even go there.
She will fight you.
She will cut you. Okay. So another story of Atalanta's life. When Artemis was forgotten at a sacrifice by a king, she was very angered and sent the Caledonian boar, a wild boar that ravaged the land, men, and cattle and prevented crops from being sown. So Atalanta joined Meleager and many other famous heroes on a hunt for the boar. Now, many of the men were angry that a woman was joining them, but Meleager, though married, lusted for Atalanta and so persuaded them to include her. So this must be before
he put her away.
Yeah. Now, several of the men were killed before Atalanta became the first to hit the boar and draw blood. After Meleager finally killed the boar with his spear, he awarded the hide to Atalanta. Okay. Now, his uncles, Meleager's uncles, were angry and tried to take the skin from her. So in revenge, Meleager kills his uncles. Wild with grief, Meleager's mother, Althea, threw a charmed log on the fire, which consumed Meleager's life as it burned. So maybe it was after the Argonauts, if she wasn't with them. It's Greek mythology. Everything's very confused.
Yeah, people come now, back. People disappear.
Here is the best part.
Okay, I'm ready. I'm strapped in.
I literally have titled it the best part.
You did. It's in all caps.
In all caps. So after the boar hunt, Atalanta was rediscovered by her father, who had abandoned her on a mountainside to be raised by a bear. Now, he wanted her to be married, but Atalanta, uninterested in married, agreed she would only marry if her suitors could outrun her in a foot race. Those who lost would be killed. The king agreed, and many young men died in the attempt
to beat her.
She ran them through with a spear. I mean,
didn't beat me. Stop.
Bye.
Stop. I love that they volunteered. Right.
They're like, you're beautiful. I could definitely beat a woman in a foot race.
Oh, I could.
Honey,
die.
You're dead.
Bye.
So Hippomenes comes along and he asks the goddess Aphrodite for help. So she gave him three golden apples in order to slow Atalanta down. The apples were irresistible, so every time Atalanta got ahead of Hippomenes, he rolled an apple ahead of her and she would run after it.
Okay.
In this way, he won the foot race and came to marry her. So basically, he effing cheated, okay? There's no rules about you can throw some golden apples and like get all your shenanigans in here.
She should have been like Chris Woodworth and had all those loopholes closed in
That's
her
right.
syllabus.
That's right. That is so right.
That's so a now none of our audience is gonna get.
It's totally fine.
It's okay.
So he won the foot race. They do get married. Eventually they have a son, Parthenopius, who was one of the seven against Thebes, and Zeus's mother Rhea turned Atalanta and Hippomenes into lions after they made love together in one of Zeus's temples. Now, other accounts say that Aphrodite changed them into lions because they did not give her proper honor. The point is, there was this belief at the time that lions couldn't mate with their own species. Lions could only mate with leopards. So the curse was that Atalanta and Hippomenes would never be able to like remain one with one another if they were both lions.
How did they get more lions?
They mated with leopards. I mean, they're in Greece. Lions and leopards are in Africa. They are very not clear on what's happening. There's no information.
That's a very
This
good
is
point.
Not Wakanda. We don't know anything. This is Greece. We're dumb and stupid. And we throw golden apples at fast women to win. Hashtag Wakanda forever. Yeah.
Now, is the city of Atlanta named after Atalanta?
So Atlanta was named by J. Edgar Thomson, chief engineer of the Georgia Railroad. He gave varying stories about how he came up with the name, but personal favorite is that the city was named for former Governor Wilson Lumpkin's daughter. Her middle name was Atalanta after the fleet-footed goddess.
Oh.
So that does it. If I ever have a daughter, I would name her Diana Atalanta and just be like, crush the world.
You.
In a good way.
Yeah. That's quite the
that's quite the mantle to pass on, huh?
Crush the world.
I mean, that's what I say every day when I wake up.
I live my life at a constant 11.
I do.
I know you do.
Crush the world.
I know you do.
Side note, you should hear Preston do an imitation of my inner monologue. It's basically like, can I sleep? Nope. Allison doesn't sleep. Gotta keep doing more stuff. Gotta send some emails. Can I take a break and eat some dinner? Nope. I don't need food. I'll just keep working.
It's funny. Your inner monologue sounds a lot like my inner monologue.
It totally is.
Maybe
it's
that's
great.
Why we get along so well.
Oh my God. It's so good. Oh, okay. This is a blast. Okay. I'm ready.
Are you ready for the story of Europa?
I am ready.
Okay. Now, I am going to read this straight out of Edith Hamilton's mythology.
Oh, good. We can end story time with a real story time.
Yes. I have also read Edith Hamilton's mythology cover to cover.
We should do Edith Hamilton at some point.
Yes, please. Up in heaven one spring morning, as he idly watched the earth, Zeus suddenly saw a charming spectacle. Europa had waked early, troubled just as Io had been by a dream, only this time not of a god who loved her, but of two continents, who each in the shape of a woman tried to possess her. Asia, saying that she had given her birth and therefore owned her. And the other, as yet nameless, declaring that Zeus would give the maiden to her. See where this is going?
Oh no.
Once awake from this strange vision, which had come at dawn, the time when true dreams oftenest visit mortals, Europa decided not to try to go to sleep again, but to summon her companions, girls born in the same year as herself and all of noble birth, to go out with her to the lovely blooming meadows near the sea. Here was their favorite meeting place, whether they wanted to dance or bathe their fair bodies at the river mouth or gather flowers. This time, all had brought baskets, knowing that the flowers were now at their perfection. Europa's was of gold, exquisitely chased with figures which showed, oddly enough, the story of Io, her journeys in the shape of a cow, the death of Argus, and Zeus lightly touching her with his divine hand and changing her back into a woman. I think it's clear at this point that we have to do Io at some point in the future.
Also, yes. I love this episode. More of this.
It was, as may be perceived, a marvel worth gazing upon, and had been made by no less a personage than Hephaestus, the celestial workman of Olympus.
Wow.
Lovely as the basket was, there were flowers as lovely to fill it with. Sweet-smelling narcissus and hyacinths and violets and yellow crocus, and most radiant of all, the crimson splendor of the wild rose. The girls gathered them delightedly, wandering here and there over the meadow, each one a maiden fairest among the fair. Yet even so, Europa shone out among them as the goddess of love outshines the sister graces. And it was that very goddess of love who brought about what next happened. As Zeus in heaven watched the pretty scene, she who alone can conquer Zeus, along with her son, the mischievous boy Cupid, shot one of her shafts into his heart, and that very instant he fell madly in love with Europa.
Oh no.
Even though Hera was away, he thought it well to be cautious, and before appearing to Europa, he changed himself into a bull. Not such a one as you might see in a stall or grazing in a field, but one beautiful beyond all bulls that ever were. Bright chestnut in color, with a silver circle on his brow and horns like the crescent of the young moon. He seemed so gentle as well as so lovely that the girls were not frightened at his coming, but gathered around to caress him and to breathe the heavenly fragrance that came from him, sweeter even than that of the flowery meadow.
Wow.
It was Europa he drew toward, and as she gently touched him, he lowed so musically, no flute could give forth a more melodious sound. Then he lay down before her feet and seemed to show her his broad back, and she cried to the others to come with her and mount him. And she said, "For surely he will bear us on his back. He is so mild and dear and gentle to behold. He is not like a bull, but like a good, true man, except he cannot speak."
Wow.
Smiling as she sat down on his back, the others, quick though they were to follow her, had no chance. The bull leaped up and at full speed rushed toward the seashore, and then not into, but over the wide water.
What?
As he went, the waves grew smooth before him, and a whole procession rose up from the deep and accompanied him. The strange sea gods, Nereids, riding upon dolphins, and Tritons blowing their horns, and the mighty master of the sea himself, Zeus's own brother. Europa, frightened equally by the wondrous creature she saw in the moving waters all around, clung with one hand to the bull's great horn and with the other caught up in her purple dress to keep it dry.
Priorities.
And the winds swelled out the deep folds even as a sail swells on a ship, and ever gently thus they wafted her. No bull could this be, thought Europa, but most certainly a god. And she spoke pleadingly to him, begging him to pity her and not leave her in some strange place all alone. He spoke to her in answer and showed her she had guessed rightly what he was. She had no cause to fear, he told her. He was Zeus, the greatest of gods, and all he was doing was from love of her. He was taking her to Crete, his own island, where his mother had hidden him from Cronus when he was born. And there she would bear him glorious sons whose scepters shall hold sway over all men on earth. Everything happened, of course, as Zeus said. Crete came into sight, they landed, and the Seasons, the gatekeepers of Olympus, arrayed her for her bridal. Her sons were famous men, not only in this world, but in the next, where two of them, Minos and Rhadamanthus, were rewarded for their justice upon the earth by being made judges of the dead in Hades. Mm-hmm. But her own name remains the best known of all. And that's where Edith leaves it.
Whoa.
Some other addendums and some other additions mm-hmm. that Edith doesn't include in her story. After she goes missing, her father, Agenor, had ordered her brothers to cross the whole world and not to return if they hadn't found.
Wow.
Europa had four brothers. Cilix, the eldest brother, was searching for a long time but had no success, ends up in Asia Minor, where he names Sicilia after him and becomes a king. Thasus eventually lands on the island of Thasos, also giving it his name, and reigns there.
Right.
And then Phoenix goes to Africa. Cadmus, the youngest and most beloved brother of Europa, asks the Oracle of Delphi what to do. The priests of the Oracle told him not to worry about his sister because she was safe. And then he goes off and becomes a king in his own place as well. Now, it's said when Europa died that Zeus transformed her into a star complex and that he himself took again the shape of the white bull to merge into the complex with her. The Taurus constellation is believed to be that form of Zeus.
Oh, wow.
Today, the name Europa is, of course, the namesake for Europe. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the I think it's either the euro coin or the 2 euro coin has the image of Europa on the back of the bull.
Oh, cool.
And, of course, one of Jupiter's 16 moons right. is named Europa. And it's also one of the most interesting moons we know of in the galaxy because it's the only one we know of so far to have water.
Love it.
So that is the story of Europa.
Cool. Yeah. Our cause this week, since it's been story time, is the Children's Literacy Initiative. They work with teachers, they coach teachers, they supply classrooms, and host workshops. They're a nonprofit organization that provides educators with training and coaching in the most effective practices for early literacy instruction for pre-kindergarten through third grade. Their workshops and institutes build teachers' understanding of literacy and the art and science of teaching children how to read and write. They create a sustainable school-wide culture of literacy that introduces students to the joys of reading, writing, and lifelong learning.
Yes.
You can find more information about them at CLI, Children's Literacy Initiative.org. CLI.org.
Yes. If you have other stories you would like us to tell, more myths or legends or women you would like us to cover here on the Bitchery of History.
Or interview.
You can find us on Facebook. Just search the Bitchery of History.
We are on Twitter. Search Bitchery Podcast.
Or you can find us on Instagram at the Bitchery of History.
There are some amazing photos up there. You got to check it out.
Oh my God. Shout out to Jess. It is amazing.
Beautiful. Yes. As always, we could not make any of these episodes happen without you, our listeners and supporters, and our whole production team, Jeanette,
Kim,
Sydney,
and Jess.
Thank you.
Yes. You can also find us at umpboh.com, where not only can you contact us on our listener submission page, but also you can get stickers. We have stickers of three women, as well as the stickers we handed out at the March for Our Lives, which you can see pictures of on our Instagram.
And remember,
bitches get stuff done.